This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
About our ummah as a group. وَاعْتَصِمُوا بِحَبْلِ اللَّهِ جَمِيعًا. And hold on to the rope. That's the word he used, بِحَبْلِ اللَّهِ, the rope of Allah. And the scholars for years, for centuries have talked about what does he mean by that? Does he mean the Qur'an? Does he mean the deen? Does he mean the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam? Does he mean each other? And it doesn't really matter. You can take all of them, you can take one of them. It all leads to the same thing at the end. The word that really is of interest is the word جَمِيعًا that happens after it. So however you want to understand Hablullah subhanahu wa ta'ala, go ahead, but you're still stuck with jami'an right after it, as in together, as in as a group, not divided. A few verses later on, kuntum khayra ummatin, the same group of verses, kuntum khayra ummatin ukhrijat linnas, you were indeed the best nation that was presented to people. Ta'muruna bil ma'rufi wa tanhauna 'anil munkari wa tu'minuna billahi walau amana ahlul kitabi la khayra lakana khayran lahum. You command that which is good and you discourage people from that which is not. And the word, and the concept of Amr al-Ma'ruf and Nahi anil Munkar is a social one. I want to take a moment, just point that out for you. It's really not religious in its nature. What I mean by that is that Amr al-Ma'ruf and Nahi anil Munkar is not referring to da'wah. They're two different things. Da'wah is when you call people to the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You teach them the deen, you give them the basic rulings and laws of Islam. This is not that. Amr al-Ma'ruf and Nahi anil Munkar is different. It's different. I'm not saying that this da'wah is not important. Obviously, it's important. I don't need to explain that to you. We've already agreed on that long time ago. That's why you're here. That's why I'm standing here. But Amr bil Ma'ruf and Nahi anil Munkar is a little bit different. It's talking about the maintenance of society. The way you maintain a society is that you evaluate the good and the bad within it in terms of the norms, the customs, the culture that exists amongst people. What is it that they value a lot? And what is it that they don't care about too much? And Amr bin Ma'ruf and Nahi al Munkar is the maintenance of that societal system. It's pointing out that which is good, encouraging it, commanding it, helping people embrace it and take it upon themselves. And Nahi al Munkar is that which people look at and say isn't good. And then continuing that, saying it's not good, we agree, let's continue to keep it that way. And then when the community has something that's wrong, then you don't use Amr bin Ma'ruf and Nahi al Munkar. That's where you bring Islah. That's where reform is required. That's where you bring in the Islamic law and you start arguing. That's where you have to stand there and debate. This is not right. What the community agrees to be correct is not correct. And we do that as well as Muslims. We do that as well. But Amr bin Ma'ruf and Nahi al-Munkar is just acknowledging what is good. What are the good values that we've got? What are the good stuff? What are the stuff that we see to be correct and they are? And the stuff that we see to be wrong and they are? Let's continue to enforce that. Let's reinforce that. Let's make sure. That's what we do as Muslims. We come to any society and we look, what do you got? What are your values? All right, let's take a look. All right, these ones here we have to change. These are a problem. We'll talk about that from an Islam. That's Islah, that's Dawah. But over here, you have a lot of nice values. We agree with all of this stuff. And that's where Amr bin Ma'ruf and Nahi al-Munkar comes in. And we don't do a lot of that. We do a lot of the first piece. We do a lot of the where's the wrong stuff that we need to change. And that's fine. I'm not saying that's not important. It really is. And we haven't done a very good job at it that either, to be honest. But I want to talk a little bit about the concept of Amr bin Ma'ruf and Nahi al-Munkar, so you understand what it means. When you're living in a society and they value their elderly, and they value taking care of the vulnerable, and they value equality and diversity, and they value these things, even if they don't do it well. I'm not talking about the implementation. Maybe the implementation is all wrong, that's fine. But the values are there. Then as Muslims, we come along and we strengthen that. We make it stronger, not weaker. We come to a society where things are going well and we make whatever is going well better. Whatever it is that they believe in that is good, we will make the belief in that goodness stronger. We come to a society that is looking at a problem and saying, this is a problem, we agree it's a problem. We will stand with them even, we will strengthen their stance against that problem. Not the opposite. Muslims don't come to society and change everything in it. No, they evaluate. Muslims have to evaluate what is good and what's working well and what is not. In the society, they may not agree that drugs are haram, but they don't look at them in a positive manner. Societally speaking, they still look at it in a negative way. It's not a good thing. Stay away from it. They have campaigns. That's where we agree with them. Yes, we agree. This is not a good thing. So we engage in Amr al-Ma'ruf and Nahi al-Munkar regarding that because they already agree with it. It's when we don't agree with them, when there's a specific behavior that we say, no, we don't like that one, that's where we bring Islah. That's where we bring reform. That's where we have to have our ducks in a row. We have to have our proper arguments. We have to make sure that we have a platform for our voices so that we can actually challenge their status quo, challenge their norm, challenge what it is that they're looking at by bringing Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's narrative into the arena. But when things are agreed upon that are good, then we have to strengthen them. And that's why I'm sharing with you the whatever is left of the survey. Jazakumullah khair, the brothers and sisters from Dar al-Arqam who decided to put this survey together. There's information here. This information is helpful for us. It allows us to continue this legacy of Amr bin Ma'ruf and Nahi al-Munkar by identifying that which is doing well so we can strengthen it, and that which is not so we can change it. But we have to be able to know what's happening first. How do you change, or how do you help a community? How do you actually identify where your Amr bin Ma'ruf and Nahi al-Munkar exists and where your Islah and Da'wah exists if you have no idea what's happening? If there's no clarity in terms of what the values and the norms and the customs are within a community. And I want to share with you, before I go through some of this data, a personal observation that I've put together over the last 10 years. And I couldn't have done it any earlier because of the fact that life changes as we get older. But we have a lack of certain age groups' presence within our Islamic institutions. There's a lack of certain age groups. They don't exist within our Islamic institutions in terms of volunteering, in terms of actually doing work. And this is the problem. When you look at the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam building his core group, he had this beautiful, this wide spectrum of people from different age groups. He had young people, early teens, and 20s. He had people in their 30s and 40s. And he had people who were elder in their 60s. Alayhi salatu wasalam invested in all of them. And it's through that investment that actually he was able to make the impact he made, alayhi salatu wasalam, because he didn't stick to only one group of people. He didn't just look at one demographic. Okay, I'll only talk to this age group. If you're not of that age group, remove. Or I'll only speak to this gender, for example. The other one, they're not involved. He spoke to everyone. And because he did that, alayhi salatu wasalam, his impact was so profound and it spread so quickly and through his life and after he passed away, alayhi salatu wasalam. But I thought it was normal growing up in a masjid where it's either children or people who are retired. Because I ran a masjid like that. There was this old masjid in the village that no one wanted to go to anymore. If you made sujood on the actual sujood without your own prayer mat, you would go into an asthma attack. This masjid was very old. The walls were all rock. It was built by Sheikh Muhyiddin al-Qadri, Allah yarhamu, Sheikh Ibrahim al-Ghalayini. These are people, these are great scholars who came and built the first masjid in this small village, and they prayed in it for years, and then they built a nice big one, and everyone moved to that one. So they needed someone to run this masjid. They found this ignorant 17-year-old to do it, so I did it. I ran the masjid, and my masjid was with a bunch of kids, children that I taught from school, my brothers and their friends, grade sixes and sevens and fives and threes, and and all of the elderly, all of the grandfather figures, and I thought that was normal. And I just got accustomed to masajid being only people who are retired or children who their parents don't want to spend too much time teaching, so just send them to the masjid and the sheikh will fix them for them. But then there's a demographic, and I was young. I was 20 and 21 and 22, so in my teens, I thought that was normal. But now as I'm getting a little bit older, I'm not that old, but as I get older and I look around, I'm noticing that what I have in masajid are people in their early 20s, children, and elderly. I don't have the 30s, 40s, and 50-year-olds. They don't come here. They're too busy. They're mashallah accomplished, and they have too much on their plate. So they have no time to actually come and volunteer and do anything. They may come and sit on a board, make some decisions, sign some papers, and leave, but nothing else aside from that. And I've noticed this to be an actual issue. Like, I'm watching and I'm saying, yeah, this is missing. I don't know how I'm going to be able to teach younger people how to volunteer, what adab and mannerism they're going to have in volunteering, how they're going to act like for younger boys. I'm not going to talk about the girls, even though it's parallel, but I'm talking about it from the boys' perspective because this is what I see on a daily basis. I don't know how these boys are going to learn to be men if I have no men around. If it's just me and two other people who show up and the rest are all under a certain age group. They don't learn very well from themselves. I don't know if you've noticed, but if you put people from the same age group, same demographic, with each other, with no external forces at all, that's not a very good recipe. Not a lot of good comes from that. You need that external effect. When I look around, it's not there. People don't have time. They don't have time. And I ask them, show up. Yeah, inshallah, when I have time. And I say yes, but in my mind, like, honestly, no time at all. You don't have 1 hour a week. You can't carve out an hour and a half in a week to come and do something. That is maybe not exactly what your expertise demands. That's not just focusing on whatever skill set you picked up from university and through your job, but just actually coming and existing amongst people and talking to them and helping them and figure out what they're going to do next. We have a lack of that. I've been talking about mentorship for 7 years straight. I am bored of using the word. Actually, I don't even like listening to the word anymore. I hate the word because I keep on, it's used everywhere now. But people don't seem to understand me. Yeah, if we don't have that networking aspect of things, if people from different age groups aren't willing to show up and give some of their time, not just their wealth, wealth is a whole other problem that we'll talk about, but from their time and their expertise and their experience, then we're not going to get very far. And if you need me to give you examples from the Sunnah, from the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam's life, and from the Sahaba around him, I can do that. It's easy. See, they all made sure they did that. And he made sure that they all did that. Alayhi salatu wasalam made sure that they did things that may have been 40 years before in Jahiliyyah and something they wouldn't do because it was beneath them at the time. If you hit a certain age and you had a certain amount of wealth and you were respected in a certain manner, then you didn't have to do certain things anymore. You didn't have to sit at the wall and listen to a couple of gremlins read Quran. You didn't have to sit and talk to about a couple of snotty brats running around. You didn't have to do that because that wasn't your piece. But I don't see that being the case during the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam's life. During his life, he gave an example of someone who engaged with all demographics of community on every level. You would find him, alayhi salatu wasalam, speaking to elderly women for hours upon hours, trying to help them fix their problems. He would go to the alleys and spend time with children and talk to them and ask them questions about their pets and their birds. And if they needed help with something and listen to them, alayhi salatu wasalam would engage with all aspects. He would spend time with Ahlul Sufa, those who were the most vulnerable of the Muslims, those who didn't have places to live. Those who were so poor that they didn't have a place to live, they lived in the masjid. He would spend time with them and see and figure out ways to help them. And you look at the Sahaba, they did the same. They did exactly the same. No one was exempted from Muhajirin wal Ansar, by the way. No one was exempted. You don't have to give up your house. No, everyone had to give up their home. Everyone had to open their home. Even those who could afford to buy homes for people, you still had to open yours. You still had to divide your own home. Yeah, buy one for someone else. Great, jazakallah khair. But someone's coming into your house. If you're not willing to go that far, then you don't. It was a way for them to differentiate who was really committed and who wasn't. Who was actually a part of this community and who wasn't. And he didn't have to go around saying who was munafiq and who wasn't. People undressed themselves. People exposed themselves to their own nifaq by the choices they made and what they did in their lives. Because he would demand alayhi salatu wasalam a certain standard. And those who wouldn't meet that standard would expose themselves. So even though Hudhayfa knew them by heart, a lot of the Muslims already knew. They know fulan. They would say, you'd read the books. وَفُلَانُ كَانَ مُنَافِقًا بَيْنَ النِّفَاقِ You find that wording. He was a munafiq who was clear his nifaq. We didn't need Hudhayfa to tell us. It was obvious. This person had no interest in engaging in anything. He was not a part of our community at all. This piece has to be brought back in again. I'm sorry. I know you're busy. And I know you have a lot of meetings. And I know you have to exist. You have to be here. A part of your sadaqah is not just your money, but it's your time. And honestly, we're not doing very good when it comes to money, so I don't really feel that you're exempted anyways. Time is needed. You need to exist. You have to be there. You have to actually show up, and you have to help with things. Let me give you an example. I love this story. I'll end the first piece of the khutbah with this story, and then we'll go through some of the slides. Sayyidina Umar ibn Khattab was always impressed by Abu Bakr. At the beginning, he competed with him in a good way. He wanted to be as good as Abu Bakr. He figured out later on, during the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam's life, he couldn't do it. Abu Bakr was just always one step ahead. So he accepted that in a good way, in a brotherly way, in a loving way. So he was always impressed by this man's character, and he watched him during Abu Bakr's khilafah. Abu Bakr was now the khalifa of the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam. He was ruling at the time all of Arabia, parts of northern Egypt, most of the southern parts of what today is Jordan, Syria, and Iraq, and parts of today Iran, which is a big empire. Way bigger than what he left alayhi salatu wasalam, way bigger than the Arabs ever thought they were going to have. Like even during Abu Bakr's time, they were like, this is beyond our wildest dreams. And he was able to establish a strong hold on all these lands through Hurub al-Ridda. And after Salat al-Fajr, on a certain day a week, he would disappear. And Umar was observant. He would see this. He would see that Abu Bakr would not exist. And the story, you find it in the Hilyat al-Awliya. You'll find it in the collection of al-Dhahabi. He tells the story. And he just disappeared. And Umar was very observant. So he noticed that every Tuesday or whatever, after Fajr, where do you go? And Abu Bakr would just kind of answer him, not really give him an answer. I have something to do. And just go on. They had a lot to deal with. But Umar was just, so he followed him. He watched Abu Bakr enter a home and spend there a couple of hours and then leave. So as Umar would say, فَظَرَنْتُ سُوءًا. And I had a bad assumption. Oh, what is he doing? You know how it is, right? Married men going to houses on their own. Never good news. Never good news. If someone's disappearing, no one knows where they are and they're coming up. Never good news. So Umar's like, oh, what are you doing? This is scary. So he goes in. He's expecting the worst. He finds this elderly blind lady. This elderly blind lady. And he asks her, من كان عندك? Who was here a while ago? فقالت رجل لا أعرفه. So he said, what do you mean, لا تعرفين? What do you mean? He comes to you, doesn't know. قالت والله لا أعرف. I don't know who this person is. يأتيني منذ سنين. For years now. يأتيني كل يوم كذا. Every day of the week on this day, he comes in the morning. فيغسل لي ويكنس داري ويرقع ثوبي. He comes and he cleans the house for me. And he sews any clothing that is ripped. And he ويطبخ لي طعاما. And he makes some food enough for me for the couple of days. ثم ينصرف. والله لا أعرفه. I don't know who he is. قال فجلس عمر يبكي. عمر sat in his house and started to cry. يقول ما يصنع بعدك الناس يا أبا بكر. What do people do after you, Abu Bakr? أتعبت من بعدك. You've made it so difficult for people to follow you, Abu Bakr. How do we follow you? How do we follow you? It's impossible. How do I do this? Umar is thinking to himself, I'm you know, I know he's ahead of me, but I'm keeping up a good standard. And then he sits there and he feels like, how do I do this? But Abu Bakr understood something that Umar radiallahu anhu would learn from him. That it's not, I know, you're the leader. You're the supreme leader of the land. It doesn't take away the fact that you still have a spot here on the ground with the rest of us. You know, here down in the mud, We're working with the people who are struggling, those who don't have what they need on a daily basis, those who have different types of challenges with the children, with the people. You still have a spot here. That spot is vacant. It's waiting for you. You still have to come and sit here too. You still have to be a part of this. You cannot distance yourself from that. You can't. As a Muslim, you can't. I'm sorry, you can't. I don't care how many PhDs come and how many DRs and other letters that come after your name and how big your signature is and how many people vouch for it. It doesn't matter. You're not bigger than the Rasulullah alayhi salatu wasalam. You're not more mighty than Abu Bakr was during his life. And they understood the importance of just doing basic work, just coming and making sure they're a part of things. And that's why Umar al-Khattab, and the reason I tell you this story, because he's the same one who, when he saw the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam playing with a couple of six-year-olds, he said, Ya Rasulullah, ma tasna? What are you doing? There's an ummah that needs to be taken care of. Yaqulu ya Umar, ama sami'at, didn't you hear the news? The hadith in Imam Ahmad. What is the news, Ya Rasulullah? Qala mat al-nughayr. This small bird died today. You didn't hear the news? His bird died. What's wrong with you, Umar? Qala fasakata. He stood there quietly. It didn't make sense to him at the beginning. It made sense to him later. فَكَانَ أَرْحَمَ النَّاسِ بِأُمَّتِهِ رَضِيَ اللَّهُ عَنْهُ وَأَرْضَهُ سيدنا عمر, later when he understood. But we have to understand the same thing. Yes, you have a specific contribution based on your expertise and how far you've come in life, which is great. And that's, you're required to do that, whether you're in law or medicine or engineering or business or whatever you're good at. You have to contribute through that. But then there's the basic contribution, the basic stuff. Just showing up for salawat. Just looking for a simple opportunity for volunteerism with younger people and just sitting around and helping and doing something that you don't normally do. That's a part of this story as well. That's a part of this story as well. And it's that balance that we seek. And we don't have that right now. There is a lack of certain age groups within Masajid. Not on the boards, Jazakumullah khair, they fill the boards, but not elsewhere. And that to me is concerning and it's a problem. It's telling me that disconnect is only going to get worse. You can't expect four or five people to mentor a full community. You can't expect a couple of sisters and a couple of brothers to take care of tens and tens and tens, hundreds sometimes of younger people. It's impossible. It's not doable. أقول قولي هذا وأستغفر الله لي ولكم فاستغفروه يغفر لكم يا فوز المستغفرين استغفر الله. الحمد لله وحده وصلى الله وسلم وبارك على من لا نبي بعده وعلى آله وصحبه ومن اتبع نهجه ووفى عهده. And the reason I'm talking about this is because if you want to see a change in the future of this ummah, because honestly, some of the images that are coming out of Rafah and coming out of Gaza are beyond heartbreaking. There's things that are, you never thought you would ever see. Wallahi, I don't even know how a person can put up with this stuff. Like, whatever I do in a day, I do just to distract myself so I don't sit down and look at something or open an app or respond to an email or see something that is just completely devastating, as we live in a world that just has decided openly to just draw a blind eye to that which matters to us and to people who look like us and people who think like us and people who are us. It's not even like anymore. These are us. The people who are dying there, that's me and you. It's just a different version of us, but there's no difference really. And the fact that the world is okay with it is extremely disturbing and is devastating and telling us that we are not even remotely close to where we need to be as an ummah to be able to at least voice concerns about it or at least push against this tide of hatred, this tide of tyranny and discrimination that is flowing through this globe. And we want that to change. It starts with small steps, by the way. It starts with little things. It's not always, it sometimes starts with something simple. Like an hour that you spend helping kids or going to a homeless shelter or running a soup kitchen or just dealing with some of the youth who don't know where they're going in their lives. It starts there. It starts small. That's really where influence occurs, by the way. When you ask people who are extremely successful in life what exactly moved you, they'll tell you about this silly story. They'll tell you something really silly. And they'll fail to tell you about all the times that their parents they spent lecturing them and the time that they went to camp. They'll just tell you this one moment where they ran into someone and someone said something and it clicked, because people are on their own journeys. We never know exactly what they're thinking. Sayyidina Muhanifa would say that. Said that what really changed me was once Imam al-Shabi, Amr al-Shabi, one of the known tabi'een, saw me and said, where do you go? What do you do? And I told him, I work in the souq. And he asked me, what do you learn? Like, who teaches you? What ilm are you seeking? And I told him, I don't akhtalif to anyone. فَقَالَ مَا يَنْبَغِي أَقْلُكَ أَقْلُكَ. This brain you have, and you're not doing that. And that was the end of it. He never spoke to him again. But he just left something. If Imam al-Shabi was too busy sitting inside his house, if he was not interested in speaking to the youth of his own ummah, then we would have lost out on one of the biggest imams in our history. I want to share with you a few more points from this survey. I think I went too far. So, people have financial difficulties, especially those who come early. Those when they first get here, they get supported. First year or two, there's enough, at least there was before COVID, they got enough social support and people helped them. But then, a few years into it, they get forgotten. And between year 3 and 6, they struggle. They don't do well. They start actually not able to make ends meet. And a part of that, in my opinion, a part of that is the lack of communal engagement. Because they may get involved at the beginning when they first come here, and then they'll kind of drift away, and there's no safety nets. We're not setting anything up to make sure that we bring people back in, and that we offer them the support that they need. And it's sad that our brothers and sisters coming from parts of the world that are torn, where they are running away from oppression and persecution, after being here for a few years, they got forgotten. They get forgotten, and then they struggle, and they can't take care of themselves. And a family that can't take care of itself financially is a family that's not taking care of itself spiritually. It's a family not taking care of itself socially or ethically or even on a family level basis. They lose that connection, because if you can't make ends meet, then what you're worried about are other things. You can't worry about these quality pieces that we look at. I want to share with you, I think this is the marriage one. Yeah. We have an issue. I've been talking about marriage for the last year or so. I talked about it so much that I had to stop talking about it, so people started getting the wrong idea. I have no interest in it myself. Alhamdulillah, I've already went down that road, and I'm good where I am. But for others, we have to start having this discussion a little bit more intimately. And we have to start talking about it a little bit more on a larger scale, because we are looking at an actual problem. I believe, number-wise, we actually do have a problem. We have younger men and younger women who are not married, and the numbers of them who are beyond 20, 25, 30, and 35 is way more than what we're used to seeing in any community, whether it's here or back home or overseas, or what was maybe come 10, 15 years ago or 20 years ago. It's actually very different. There's an issue. There's a struggle that younger men and women are finding in terms of getting married and then sustaining marriage, actually keeping it running so that they're not losing it later on and kids are suffering. So this is an aspect of our lives that we have to start investing in a little bit more. And honestly, there's a problem with the way we're looking at it from the parents' perspective. Now, we can work with the single brothers and sisters in terms of what choices they need to make and how they need to see it. But not much will change if parents continue to carry the same mentality regarding marriage. If it continues to be extremely expensive, and if you continue to put up blockades and obstacles in front of marriage based on cultural necessities or cultural whims, then this will get worse. It will only get worse. And when it gets worse, I mean, it's not that it just affects the person. It affects the community at whole. In a generation or so, we'll have less youth and we'll have more fawahish, because people will sit without marriage for a long time. What do you think they're going to do? I shared a hadith the other night with people that the Sahaba started thinking of neutering themselves. They were so poor, they could not bring anything for marriage, that they started thinking, do we just do that and get rid of this whole problem? Well, people aren't going to do that, I can tell you that much. Because haram is way too easy. They won't have to. And once you start playing with that problem, once that spreads amongst a nation or a community, once haram becomes normalized, then there's really no use of living in that area anymore or being a part of that community to begin with. This is much, in my opinion, this issue is way more serious than people give the credit for. Like, people don't give enough credit to this problem. This has to be talked about. Where they don't know where to look. They don't know how to find people. They don't have enough support. There are financial problems. Some of them are talking about racism. Imagine that in the ummah of Muhammad alayhi salatu wasalam. We have people who can't get married because of racial problems. And that's just not great. We look at parents and what they struggle with and what they're looking for in terms of their own troubles and trying to teach their kids their Islamic identity or trying to make sure that they are. I find this very concerning that people are trying to parent their children and teach them to be Muslim, to feel proud about who they are and where they come from, and they struggle with that. That tells you that this community itself is not functional. It's not functioning appropriately, because a community that is will make sure that the youth within that community feel that they belong, feel that they're proud to belong to this group of people. And they have so many reasons to. They have so many reasons to feel proud that they belong. But when they don't, it just makes you question what is missing. I do realize that I come off very negative. But that's just me. I'm just very pessimistic. This has nothing to do with you. It has nothing to do with these numbers. My concern is not to look at things that are working, because what's working is working and continue to work. My problem is with that which isn't. My problem are with topics that are not working, issues and struggles and challenges and gaps that are not being fulfilled, and that we are seeing the impact of us not fulfilling them. We're seeing how it's affecting people, how people are struggling more because of it. When I know, especially when I know that we have the capacity to fix these problems, like I know we do, like I don't, there is actually no real barrier between us and between fixing these problems, aside from our own personal commitments. Islamic knowledge continues to be the number one thing that parents want for their children, which is why we have this place. This is why we started this whole place. I did this same survey, different, 6-7 years ago, and the number one box that was checked, even though the data is not very good in terms of being able to break it down, but the number one box that was checked was Islamic knowledge. They wanted their kids to learn their deen. So we decide, all right, fine, this is an echo of what you want. This is what you need. We'll start a place, and the focus will be teaching Islam. This is how we're supposed to grow. We're supposed to go out, ask people questions, gather information, get more info from them, take that information, and then use it to plan ahead or plan forward into the future to make sure that our community is meeting, we're meeting the community needs and the community requirements and closing the gaps that the people who are living on the ground feel exist in their lives. That means that everyone has to feel responsible for this, not just in filling the survey, but also in meeting some of these needs. Also in bringing themselves and making sure that they are available. Wallahi, the only way I understand life to work is that إن الله اشترى من المؤمنين أنفسهم أموالهم. Have you listened to the, are you okay with that? يا الذين آمنوا هل أدلكم على تجارة تنجيكم من عذاب أليم تؤمنون بالله ورسوله وتجاهدون في سبيل الله بأموالكم وأنفسكم. He's asking for your time, your life, and your wealth, and for that he will give you Jannah. Nah, sold, done deal or not? It's wallahi as simple as that. Is it done deal? Are you willing to offer your life, your time, Everything of who you are for the sake of Allah so that he gives you Jannah? If yes, then this will make sense to you and you'll understand where I'm going with it. And if not, then I have to wait. We have to wait until you do. Because it's simple. Islam is very simple. It's as simple as that. He's offering a transaction. Here's Jannah. Give me you. Give me yourself. Give me everything that makes who you are. Your time and your wealth and your effort and your energy. And you do that and then you see a change. You see a change. I don't know what that is. Yes, the mental health problem. We have, this is an increasing, these numbers are concerning. We have more, I think this is an underrepresentation of what actually is happening. I think there's way more than this. I think the people who filled this out are people who are coming to Masajid in our area. So they're here in a Masjid already. A lot of the people who struggle with this don't come to Masajid, so they're not reflected here appropriately. This is why we're going to look into this even more. But this is a problem. People are struggling with mental health problems and they don't have access to proper mental health professionals. Because there's a barrier within our community. People aren't reaching out on time. And this whole, look, ruqya is beautiful. Don't get me wrong. I do ruqya for my family on a daily basis. Every single day, every night. We do ruqya. That's the sunnah. You do ruqya upon yourself and the people you love every day. But this replacing mental health care with ruqya from some foreign person, which is, it could not be farther away from our deen. It could not be farther away from what Islam is. Even the concept of taking someone saying, I need someone to do ruqya for them. That is foreign. Islamically, that's foreign. You don't do that. Or else the Prophet ﷺ would have spent all day and all night just with his hand out performing ruqya on everyone. But he didn't, because everyone understood you do ruqya for those who you love. But it's not a substitution. Just like ruqya is not a substitution to a broken leg, it's not a substitution to a broken heart or a broken psyche. It's not. Just like if that breaks or that doesn't work, you take it to someone who can fix it, then you do the same. But you do it with ruqya, obviously. If you understand Islam, then when someone breaks their leg, you perform ruqya and you take them to Dr. Lawandi to fix them. But if it shouldn't be any difference when someone is struggling with depression or anxiety or any other form of mental illness, you do ruqya and you take them to someone who can help them. Or else we continue to have real struggles with this problem. I feel bad about this one. We haven't set these places up so that someone who feels discriminated against can come and find support and find answers. We can do better. We can make sure people at school and at university and at workplaces who feel that they were treated in a way that makes them uncomfortable about who they are and feel that they were targeted because of their deen or the way they look or the way they practice or how they dress, they should know where to go. And they should have a place that they go to and that they will find proper support. And that's just something I think we should all agree, we all agree to. I'll leave this last piece up. These are open-ended questions. These are what people talked about. They talked about social isolation. Talked about that they feel isolated. They don't feel that they know who to go to, especially converts. They don't know who to turn to. And I'll leave you with this last slide, inshallah ta'ala. And next week, inshallah ta'ala, we'll kind of summarize all of this, and then we'll start talking about Ramadan the week after. I hope that was a benefit to you. وَعَلَمُوا أَنَّ اللَّهَ أَمَرَنَا بِأَمْرٍ عَظِيمٍ فَقَالَ إِنَّ اللَّهَ وَمَلَائِكَتَهُ يُصَلُّونَ عَلَى النَّبِيِّ يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا صَلُّوا عَلَيْهِ وَسَلِّمُوا تَسْلِيمًا اللهم صل على محمد وعلى آل محمد كما صليت على إبراهيم وعلى آل إبراهيم وبارك على محمد وعلى آل محمد كما باركت على إبراهيم وعلى آل إبراهيم في العالمين إنك حميد مجيد وارض اللهم عن الأربعة الخلفاء السادة الحنفاء أبي بكر وعمر وعثمان وعلي وارض اللهم عن أزواجه أمهات المؤمنين وعن آله الطيبين الطاهرين وعن صحابته الغر المحجلين وعن التابعين ومن تبعهم بإحسان إلى يوم الدين وعنا معهم برحمتك يا أرحم الراحمين اللهم اغفر للمسلمين والمسلمات والمؤمنين والمؤمنات الأحياء منهم والأموات اللهم فرج هموم المهمومين ونفس كروب المكروبين وارفع الغم عن المغمومين وارفع الظلم عن المظلومين واحقن دماءنا ودماء المسلمين اللهم احقن دماء إخواننا المسلمين في غزة فلسطين وفي السودان وفي غيرها من بلاد الأرض يا رب العالمين اللهم رد المسجد الأقصى إلى رحاب المسلمين اللهم ردنا أجمعين إليك وإلى دينك ردا جميلا وتب علينا اللهم من جميع ذنوبنا توبة نصوحة طهرنا بها قلبا وجسدا وروحا وما ذلك عليك اللهم بعزيز ولا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم عباد الله إن الله يأمر بالعدل والإحسان وإيتاء ذي القربى وينهى عن الفحشاء والمنكر والبغي يعظكم لعلكم تذكرون إن شاء الله on Sunday at 5:30 we have our town hall. It's our 2-year anniversary of opening this place. You're welcome to please come and attend and give us your feedback and listen to us in terms of where we're going forward and have a conversation with us. Jazakumullah khair. Aqim as-salah.